Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and chair of this program. Our speaker today is Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan. She qualified in medicine in 1991 from Trinity College, Dublin. She trained in both neurology and clinical neurophysiology. She has been a consultant in neurology since 2004, first working at the Royal London Hospital, and now is a consultant in the clinical neurophysiology and neurology at the National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery, and for a specialist unit based at the Epilepsy Society. In that role, she has developed an expertise in working with patients with psychogenic disorders alongside her work with those suffering with physical diseases such as epilepsy. Suzanne's book about psychosomatic illness, It's All in Your Head, True Stories of Imaginary Illness, won the Wellcome Book Prize in 2006. And now our speaker, Dr. O'Sullivan.
Thanks a lot. Okay, so I want to just from the very outset just be absolutely clear what I'm here to talk about with regards to psychosomatic illness, because I find there's lots of misunderstandings, and I think it's best as I put my cards on the table from the outset. What I'm referring to when I'm talking about psychosomatic illness or disorder is a situation which a person has real physical symptoms that are causing significant disability, but cannot be explained by medical examination or by medical investigations or physical examination. So the symptom itself could be anything. And the disorder is really defined by the behavior surrounding the symptoms and the degree of disability out of proportion to any disease that can be found. I want to emphasize a couple of parts of that. First of all is the reality of the symptoms. So I'm not talking about people who have symptoms that are any less real than would be present in a disease. So the pain of a psychosomatic disorder is every bit as painful as the pain of an injury or a disease. The symptoms are also entirely outside of the control of the person who is affected. So again, I'm not talking about malingering or people who are putting on symptoms. I'm talking about things that are unconsciously generated and out of control of the sufferer. And finally, I'm talking about things that if I describe a patient to you, I take this diagnosis very seriously. It's not something that you a diagnosis that you kind of leap to in a moment. You listen to the patient, you examine them thoroughly, you investigate them appropriately. So if I tell you about somebody here today, just assume that it wasn't a sort of diagnosis made as a judgment when somebody walks in the door, but rather something that's made after consideration in the same way that you'd make any other diagnosis. Also just sort of almost as a disclaimer about myself, I'm a neurologist, so I am trained to look after people who have diseases of the nervous system. So I'm trained to look after people with purely physical diseases, things like epilepsy, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, and so forth. I have no formal training in psychiatry or psychology any more than every medical student or every junior doctor gets a degree of training, but I didn't have any more than anybody else. So why am I standing here, essentially? Well, in 2004, I was appointed to my first consultant post as a neurologist at a major London teaching hospital. And a really big part of my job in that particular role was to admit people to hospital who had seizures that were the worst sort of seizures. So usually in an epilepsy clinic or seizure clinic, most people who come and are treated for seizures, about 70% of those people, their seizures will come under control with treatment. And about 30% will not come under control. And they were the 30% that I was concerned with. So those people were admitted under my care in hospital so that I could figure out why these people were not getting better or come up with alternative strategies to make them better. And as a neurologist, you know, I expected what I would be doing is spending most of my time treating very difficult to treat epilepsy. What actually transpired in the first year of that job is that 70% of the people who are admitted to the hospital, so I bring people into hospital and I wait for them to have seizures and I witness them and we do various measurements during them. And 70% of those people had a thing that we call dissociative seizures. So when they were having seizures, if they were collapsing, convulsing on the ground, their brain waves were entirely normal. So our brain waves are constantly changing. So if you're sitting here If your eyes are open, if your eyes are closed, if you're a bit sleepy, if you're hungry at different stages of sleep, your brain waves are constantly changing. And if you're not aware of your surroundings, your brain waves will always be different than they are during waking. So even if that sort of unawareness is just due to something like sleep or anesthesia, your brain waves will look very different to a waking pattern. 70% of people I brought into hospital, when they had a convulsion, their EEG, their brain waves showed a completely normal waking pattern. And there's only one way that you can be unconscious and convulsing, but have a normal waking EEG pattern. And that's if you're having a thing called a dissociative seizure. So it's a seizure for psychological reasons rather than disease-related reasons. Again, just to make sure that everyone's completely on the same page as to what I'm talking about, if I'd been, I'm calling those dissociative seizures now, but if I'd seen those same people 100 years ago, I would be calling them hysterical seizures or hysteria. And there's been many other names since then. They've gone from hysterical seizures to pseudo-seizures, non-epileptic attacks, psychogenic non-epileptic attacks. In fact, as I always say, the only thing that has changed in the management of dissociative seizures in the last 100 years is the name, essentially. We're no better at managing them now than we were 100 years ago. So essentially, as a neurologist in 2004, I found myself abruptly in a position where a huge number of the patients I was seeing did not have a neurological disease. And the way that medicine is set up now is that, you know, we are compartmentalized. And once I see a person, I'm supposed to look for a disease. I'm supposed to look for a neurological disease. And if I don't find one, then that person is no longer my responsibility. But what, therefore, whose responsibility were these people? I mean, technically, they should have been the responsibility of psychologists or psychiatrists who have an understanding and a training in what we call liaison psychiatry, or psychiatry that kind of branches between medicine and psychiatry. There's a real lack of services in every country for things like liaison psychiatry. And the waiting lists for people who had things like dissociative seizures could be up to a year. So I was looking at a lot of young people, very often in their 20s, 30s, could be having 20 or 30 seizures a week, and basically there was nowhere to send them to. Now, that actually has not changed very dramatically since then, but what I've found myself in a position really is that I could either do what was the standard practice in medicine, which was discharge patients as no longer my responsibility, or I could try and change the situation. I'd say that I haven't been hugely successful in changing it as yet, but I'm hoping that kind of raising this sort of awareness is going to make a difference in the future. But I had to also ask myself, how could I possibly have gotten to this stage without having any being prepared in any way to know what to do with this particular patient group? Because there's nothing new in what I'm describing. Every other doctor who's a neurologist or any other sort of medical specialist is in exactly the same position as me. I wasn't in an exceptionally unusual position. And I had trained with people who had seen an equal proportion of patients with these psychosomatic disorders to me. And yet somehow I had survived all of my medical school training and my junior doctor training without ever really feeling that I'd been given any formal instruction as to what I was to do in this circumstance. And that's really what I'm trying to change at the moment, is to make these diagnoses equal to others, so that we, when a doctor is newly qualified, they have strategies for dealing with this. Now, the consequence was that I did, in my own hospital, but not in a wider way, develop a service for my specific patients. And the more you see people with things like dissociative seizures, you will see people with a lot of other similar psychogenically generated disabilities. So people with things like blindness, memory loss, paralysis, muscle spasms. I mean, essentially, if you can imagine a symptom now, then it can be generated by a psychosomatic disorder. And most people who develop something as extreme as a seizure in relation to something psychogenic will often have multiple other symptoms. So often there will be people who have a tendency to somatize. So when I say somatize, I mean someone who develops physical symptoms in the face of stress, which isn't necessarily anything wrong with you. I get physical symptoms in the face of stress, shaking hands when you're nervous. I do have laryngitis today, although I'm not completely ruling out the possibility that it's also psychogenic. And, you know, we all get these, and there's nothing wrong with that. There's not a disorder. That's just a tendency that one has. But if one has that tendency, one may develop lots of different symptoms and not a single symptom. So the consequence was I started with seizures, and soon I was seeing people with lots of other sorts of disabilities. So I wanted you to kind of tell you the trajectory of the typical story of one of the people that I've seen quite recently, just to kind of address the issues that surround this diagnosis. So this particular woman is called Olivia. She was in her late 20s when I met her. She, long before I met her, she had fallen ill with abdominal pain. When she was kind of in her late teens, around the finishing school stage of her life, she developed abdominal pain. Now, she went down a trajectory that I see many patients like her going down, which is that she had lots and lots and lots of investigations that kept coming back repeatedly as normal, to the point where she was having laparoscopies, so she was having operations to look inside her to try and establish the cause of this stomach pain. And when nobody could find anything wrong, it was just ultimately labeled as sort of a medical mystery, and it was treated symptomatically with things like painkillers. And ultimately, we can't say exactly what happened back then, but ultimately she came away from that experience just on different sorts of painkillers. A while after that, she started developing difficulties passing urine. And this was put down after several different tests to a possible urinary tract infection, as she was treated with antibiotics, got a bit better for a while, but then got worse again, and then ended up on more antibiotics. And this was kind of a recurring scenario until she found herself on regular low-dose antibiotics for a long period of time. So at this stage, she's a young woman in her early 20s who's on regular painkillers and regular antibiotics. This actually got to a stage at one point where she had a flare-up and she was completely unable to pass urine and had to learn to self-catheterize, so pass a tube into her own bladder to empty it when she was going through particularly difficult times. I didn't meet her until a few years after that, when she had she was on holiday. She slipped in a bathroom and she hit her head on a tiled floor. She didn't lose consciousness, but it was, I think, a pretty hard bang on the floor. She was okay, but on the day that it happened, but a couple of days later, she developed paralysis down one side. She was seen by a doctor in the place where she was on holidays and then transferred back to London, and tests were all entirely normal. And this had always been a scenario for Olivia, is that everything that happened to her was accompanied by lots of normal tests and potentially a new medication, but no kind of really conclusive explanation. She came to my attention when, during the course of her admission for investigation for her hemiparesis, she started having seizures. Now, the thing about neurology and how it differs to other specialties is that our nervous systems are really amenable to measurement and are very objective. It's really possible to assess our neurological systems objectively. So pain is a very difficult symptom to investigate because you can only describe it to me and I can't measure it and based on anything other than the description. However, with the nervous system, we do have a big disparity between people who have what we call functional, which is the other word for psychosomatic in this context. Functional symptoms and disease-related symptoms are really quite different. So, for example, if somebody has paralysis because they've had a stroke affecting their brain, they've got a particular pattern of muscle weakness, a particular pattern of reflex abnormalities. So they've got objective evidence of having a brain disease, whereas if somebody who has a paralysis that is for a functional or psychosomatic reason, there will be a big disparity between their subjective signs, so in other words, how they feel, what sensation is like, how strong they feel, and objective signs like reflexes, which aren't affected necessarily by your conscious or unconscious processes. So it was very easy, in a sense, to meet with Olivia and look at the seizures in the first instance and measure her brain waves during them and say, well, that cannot be an epileptic seizure because the brain waves are normal during it. It was also very easy to look at the hemiparesis and say it did not fit with anatomy. So we're not making these diagnoses in neurology based on, because I think this is a misunderstanding, that you say something is all in someone's head because the tests are normal and you can't find any other explanation. It's very much not the case. We're saying that this is a functional or psychosomatic disorder because the clinical findings do not fit with anatomy and the subjective and objective findings do not tally with each other. So it's really a very sound diagnosis. So the problem then, of course, is that Olivia has come to me not because I'm a psychiatrist or because I'm a psychologist. Olivia has come to see me because I'm a neurologist. And the last thing she is expecting is for me to say that I believe that all of this has a psychological cause rather than having a disease-related cause. And that sort of creates a really difficult situation. And that's part of the problem also, is that patients are coming to see doctors who are medically trained in physical diseases, whereas the doctors who are potentially better trained to have these difficult conversations with patients are not the people that they're going to see. But I'll come back to that in a second with regards to what we need to do about this. So basically, I now am in a position where I have to tell Olivia that I believe that all of her problems are psychological, and that's really where a very difficult conversation arises. First of all, she's not expecting it. And secondly, a number of key questions always arise because people consider this diagnosis to be a disparaging one. They consider it to be a downgrading of, you know, I came in with a stroke and now you're telling me that I'm mad. And this is, you know, this is the key to this diagnosis, is that I make sure they realize that's not what I'm telling them. So the first, they're invariably I will face the identical questions or comments every time. So Olivia and most people, the first thing that everyone says to me is, after I've tried to explain the diagnosis to them in the way I have explained it to you, say, so you think there's not, you're saying there's nothing wrong with me. And because that is the language that surrounds this disorder, is that people believe that if you have ruled out a disease, that you are saying there is something, there is nothing wrong with that person. And I hear that language repeatedly said, or you know, there was nothing physically wrong with her, it's just psychological. If somebody can't move one side, they're having seizures, there is something wrong with them. And that's really what I need to communicate to Olivia, is that this should not be considered to be a dismissal of any sort. A disability is a disability until you treat it and make it better. And whether it transpires to have a psychological cause or whether it transpires to have an organic cause only affects what you do next. It doesn't affect the level of disability that that person is suffering at that moment. And the truth is that Olivia would be right to be very upset at the diagnosis, because in many regards, it is a much, much more difficult diagnosis than the one she was expecting. So, for example, if I see a patient with epilepsy for the first time, I mean, I don't wish to say that epilepsy is an easy diagnosis. It isn't. But, you know, the treatment is a medication, and it doesn't have any implications with regard to sort of, you know, why has it happened to me? Is it something in my life? Is it something I've done? You have a 70% chance of going into remission on the appropriate medication. Whereas someone in Olivia's situation with dissociative seizures probably only has a 30% chance that her seizures will get better. And the treatment I'm probably going to suggest to her is going to be very difficult, because it's going to involve more psychological therapy or psychiatric therapy rather than taking a tablet, which is can often be very, very difficult road to go down. So most patients get very upset at the diagnosis because they feel it's a dismissal, whereas actually in many regards, it's actually a much, much more difficult diagnosis. It's also much more difficult if you consider what you now have to tell your family, friends, and your boss. You know, if you ring up and say, well, I'm going to be off work for 3 months because I've had a stroke and you're 28, people are going to be pretty horrified on your behalf and very supportive of you. I think people have an automatic shift in their sympathy levels if you say that the problem has a psychological basis rather than a disease-related basis. So if anything, I would say that patients are in a more difficult situation, but they can be made better, and that's why it's such a shame if it isn't addressed properly. I mean, the second thing that always arises in context of this diagnosis is that people say, well, you think I'm doing it on purpose. So I think there's a real issue surrounding people's kind of worry about the volitional component for these kind of disorders. And I think doctors worry that they're being tricked. And, you know, those comedy sketches where someone's in a wheelchair and every time the doctor turns around, they jump up and dance a jig or something. Maybe that's an English sense of humor, which is, maybe you don't do that over here. But basically, you know, there's this sort of, you know, are they doing it on purpose or is it, do they know? And it becomes a real issue of judgment. Now, in my own personal practice, I don't even worry about that. If you're desperate enough to come into hospital and you can't walk, you got a problem and I've got to sort it out. And I'm not going to spend days worrying about how much insight you have. However, I do want to address the insight because it is a problem. Many of these sort of patients, the disability isn't as complete as it would be in somebody who has a disease. So if I give you another example, I've seen several people who are profoundly blind for functional reasons, so psychosomatic reasons. So if you examine the person and ask them to see something, they can only see a little bit of light and they can't see anything else at all. All of the objective part of the examination is normal. So pupils respond normally. You can do electrical tests to test the integrity of nerve pathways and they're all normal. The person sometimes, and this is where the problem arises, is that these sorts of functional blindness are usually not absolutely complete. So in distracted moments, people will behave as if they can see. So I would have a patient, for example, who, you know, in moments sitting on the ward, she will reach out and pick something up, which she couldn't have picked up if she hadn't been able to see it. Whereas if you asked her if she could see it, she would tell you she absolutely could not see it. And what that leads to is a real level of misunderstanding in which people feel like this woman knows she can see, but she is pretending that she can't see. In fact, I think it's the nature of the disorder is that very often the disabilities are maintained by a level of anxious attention. So if I'm worried there's something wrong with my foot and I'm paying a huge amount of attention and it doesn't feel normal, that maintains the disability. And in distracted moments, the disability may melt away briefly. But I think, you know, that people may not be convinced by that, but I think that the behavior, the way that people seek out treatment is absolutely convincing. So if you take that blind, the blind woman, for instance, you know, there was a huge disparity between her behavior at times. So on one occasion, she actually drew me a picture, which, you know, seems like a really strange thing for someone to do when they're in hospital because they're blind. But there was a real kind of lack of understanding for her of her problem. But the point is that she sought medical investigations. She was seeking explanations in a very active way. I think people who are pretending to be ill don't present themselves to the doctor and say, you know, I don't trust that first MRI scan because it didn't give an explanation. Can I please have another MRI scan? People are genuinely astonished that their investigations have not shown up an explanation and are in a very sincere pursuit of a diagnosis. And it's very much the same with patients with seizures. Usually the patients with seizures have seizures in front of me. So I'm the specialist in seizures. I video seizures for a living. If you want to pretend you're having seizures, don't have them in front of me. But this is exactly what happens, is that people come to me and they have them, and that's very much to me is the clearest cry for help that a person could make because they, I think it shows an absolute lack of insight and an absolute desperation for an answer that the illness behaves in that way. If you're still not convinced that it is all in a completely unconscious process, functional MRI has added somewhat to our understanding. So if you do functional MRI, so functional MRI is where you lie someone in the scanner and ask them to perform an activity and you look at the brain activity during whatever you've asked them to do, be it reading or moving, and when they're not doing that activity, so you see which bit of brain activates. So if you look at somebody who's got what we call a functional paralysis, it's someone who can't move their leg and you believe it has a psychological cause, and you do an fMRI on that person asking them to move their leg. You then compare them with someone who moves normally, who has no medical problem. And then you compare them with someone who you ask to deliberately pretend to be paralyzed. You will get three distinctly different fMRI pictures. So pretending to be paralyzed does not look the same on a brain scan as being psychosomatically or functionally paralyzed. Now, the fact that that scan looks different to a normal, healthy person scan doesn't mean, it's sometimes I think taken to mean that someone has a brain disease. It doesn't mean that. Our brains are plastic. You know, we can retrain them. So, for example, London cab drivers before sat-navs had to have very encyclopedic knowledge of the streets of London. And they have not abnormalities, differences on their brain scans to people who drive other sorts of vehicles who don't need the extensive ability to navigate. So you can change your brain through plasticity, and that can be picked up in an fMRI scan. It doesn't mean there's something wrong with you, but it does at least tell us in people who have these functional disorders that something different is going on in their brain than someone who's pretending that they have a disorder. And what one physician called Paget said was that, you know, with people with functional paralysis, you know, they say that they cannot. It looks like they will not, but the truth is they cannot will. So there seems to be a problem with willing movement. You retain the ability to move, but you can no longer recruit that part of the brain in order to move. And that's probably something that you've trained yourself to do inadvertently. Now, the third, and that sort of kind of brings me to the third kind of main issue that arises in talking to patients like Olivia, because obviously the next kind of thing that people wonder is, how could I possibly, you're telling me that I'm unconscious, and or that I'm not unconscious, but I am, etc. I confuse myself there, but basically trying to understand when a doctor is telling you that your brainwaves are showing that you're awake, but you're actually unconscious, is a very difficult concept for people to grab hold of. It's very hard for people to believe their brains can do that. Similarly, things like paralysis. You know, I think if we had a better kind of grip of how this happens or what the mechanism for this is, that it would be a lot easier for people to accept. Now, I'm not saying that I know the mechanism, but I think that there's many kind of precedents in life that go along with that are sort of physiological things that happen to us that are linked to these things that cause disability. So it used to be sort of 100 years ago, again, going back to more kind of Freudian times, we used to, and this has actually survived really until now, but very much it began 100 years ago. We thought these were what we call conversion symptoms. So in other words, something psychologically traumatic happens to you, and then you can't face that, so you bury it in your unconscious, and then it comes out as a physical symptom, and you're unaware of the psychological trauma that that brought it about. And then the treatment is that you uncover that psychological trauma and the symptom miraculously melts away. I mean, I wouldn't say there was nothing in that idea, but I don't think we think about it that way any longer. I think that there's multiple mechanisms for these sort of problems. So in terms of things like blindness, for example, it is probably linked in some way to the way we gate and filter sensory information. So basically, we think that we can see everything in our kind of visual field at the moment. We can't. We see what we are focusing on, and everything else is completely filled in by your imagination, and that's a completely unconscious process. And very much we see things we expect to see. I did have a video, but I didn't. You must look up the video, which is the invisible gorilla. It's a sensory attention test, where basically you have basketball players playing basketball, and you ask your audience to count the number of basketball passes. And during this, a man in a gorilla costume walks through the scene, and when the people are concentrating on the basketball passes, even though this man in the gorilla costume is the most incongruous and obvious thing in the video, people do not see it. So we are constantly filtering out sensory information. As you sit on your chairs, you don't feel the chairs underneath you. But, you know, those things we kind of accept because they're ordinary things. But it's not just the ordinary things that we filter out or that are involved in gating. And it's probably an exaggeration of these physiological, you know, we can look directly at something. It happens to all of us. You're looking for someone or at something. You're looking directly at it and you don't see it. And it's likely that these sort of exaggerated physiological mechanisms have some part to play in people developing disabilities. With regard to things like blackouts, we believe they probably are related to a thing called dissociation. So dissociation is sort of a detachment. You detach from what's going on around you, and it can cause lots of different sorts of symptoms. It can cause dizziness and lightheadedness, but it can also cause blackouts. Now, we all dissociate to a certain degree from time to time. So it's when you read a page of a book and you've read the whole page of that book and you do not have a clue what it said, or you watch the news, you think you're listening to it, you didn't take any of it in. So that's just a normal sort of dissociation. But these sort of normal mechanisms can become exaggerated in the face of particular stresses and can lead to disability. With regards to things like paralysis, I've certainly moved hugely away from thinking that these things are all related to some sort of deep psychological trauma. Very often I find that they are much more likely to be related to the way we respond to our bodies and the way we respond to injuries. So an awful lot of people, the scenario will be that, and I had this myself, I'm awash with psychosomatic symptoms, but fortunately I've overcome all of them so far. But, you know, in my case, I broke a bone in my foot and I had a non-weight-bearing cast on it. And when the cast came off, my foot was really, really wasted. And I wasn't accustomed to not being well. I thought this degree of wasting was way more than was acceptable, you know, because when you've never been sick, you just, it's shocking when something happens. And basically then I had great difficulty walking on it. And I was really convinced that every time I put my weight on it, the bone hadn't knit together. And my head was full of images of this bone like crunching. And I hopped down to my doctor one day and expressed my concern. I do recall he never looked at me once, but most of my GPs are really good. He just looked at his computer and then sent me for an x-ray. And as soon as I got the x-ray and I saw that it was fine, I just like skipped home again. So it was fine. So it was all fine. But that is how these things develop, is that you injure yourself. And then what we don't do on a normal day is pay a huge amount of attention to an arm or a leg or a foot or a back. But if you suddenly develop back pain and you've got back pain going down your legs, then suddenly you're paying attention to a part of your body that normally you really don't. And that the minute you start really paying attention to movements, they can start becoming unnatural. I always liken this also to another of my experiences, which is my complete inability to play tennis. So I will maintain, and none of you can prove otherwise, that I was very good at tennis when I was a teenager. And then at some point, I started playing squash and it changed my tennis swing. And trying to relearn a tennis swing just turned out to be utterly beyond me, because it required, you know, at an older age, the need to pay great attention to the position in which my wrist was being held. It was such an unnatural thing for me that, you know, these things have to be implicit. They have to be learned. And when you pay a huge amount of attention to normal movements, they can really start feeling unnatural. And that can actually lead to disability. So a lot of patients that I see have actually suffered an injury in the first instance. And then it's the attention that they pay to the injury and the fear and avoidance that surrounds the injury. You know, if you injure your back, you're worried it's going to affect your legs. You start paying attention to your legs. You start not doing your normal things, then that can actually lead down a very dangerous road, and it can actually lead to significant disability. The other thing that is important is our perception of what's going on with our bodies. So our perception, again, similar to our sort of sensory attention, is not as reliable as I think we would like to think it is. So we would often, as neurologists, see people with things like sleep problems or tremor, for example, and these are things we measure. So someone comes to you and says they have tremor and it's there all day and it's absolutely unbearable. So we ask people to wear a thing called an actigraphic watch, which basically just measures the movement and assesses to what degree you have tremor during the day. And there's often a huge disparity between the amount of tremor that people report and the amount of tremor that you actually measure. A similar experience in measuring sleep. So people who feel that they haven't slept at all during the night, when you look at their brain waves, which has very distinctive patterns during sleep, they've actually slept for large proportions of the night, but their perception of how much they've slept hasn't been reliable. So I think that when we develop these sort of disabilities for psychological reasons, some of them are related to psychological traumas. So sometimes there has been a significant trauma and people are having difficulty facing the pain of that trauma, or they don't acknowledge the pain of that trauma and their body speaks for them, essentially. So you may say, well, I've dealt with that loss, I've put it behind me. Perhaps you haven't put it behind you as completely as you think, and it may come out as a physical symptom in its place. it's your body telling you that things are not all right and you should pay attention. I often think of these symptoms as being a sort of, they are a friend in to a certain degree. They're telling people that they're not okay, and that they should pay more attention to what's going on. So sometimes it is absolutely traumatic related. I don't want to dismiss that side of it. About 30% of people who have things like dissociative seizures have suffered very serious trauma, such as sexual abuse, often many years before. Many people have lost a family member or had something very significant happen to them. But that's not the only way these things develop. They can also develop just through sort of our beliefs about how quickly we should recover from things, the attention we pay to our body, and the kind of perceptions and misperceptions we have about our body. So that sort of brings me back to Olivia, which is basically sort of, you know, I don't see my job when I meet people like Olivia as unraveling all of everything that has happened to her, because I don't necessarily think she had been unwell since she was in her late teens, and this had been going on for about 10 years. And sometimes you do have to pay attention to what's happened in the past, but sometimes what you really need to do is treat what's happening at the moment. If somebody's paralyzed in a wheelchair and having seizures every day, they don't need 10 years of psychoanalysis to get better, or rather, they may very well benefit hugely from 10 years of psychoanalysis to get better. What they really need is somebody to get them walking again in the next few months, not a slow process. So it generally is something that I don't overly concern myself with the immediate traumas, because I think what I need to do is get this person physically better. However, that's not to say that I don't think that it is absolutely important and that I do form impressions. I mean, it was clear to me that I couldn't prove the cause for Olivia's abdominal pain in the past, but it stands to reason if someone has one medically unexplainable disability, and they were a young person and they've had other medically unexplainable problems in the past, that if a young person is more likely to have one problem causing all their medical problems rather than multiple different problems. So I would certainly raise with Olivia the likelihood that I felt all of her problems had a psychosomatic cause, given that they had been appropriately investigated in the past. And certainly in her situation, you know, when her illness began, and this is a pattern I see very often, was when she was due, ready to leave school, she had a lot of expectations from herself and from her family that she didn't know if she was going to meet. And I would have speculated that an illness at this time was a sort of an opportunity for her to avoid failure. But I wouldn't necessarily address that with her, but refer her to a psychologist, a psychiatrist to discuss that in more detail. With regard to her more recent problem, which was her paralysis and her seizures, that had very much come about after the injury. And that was very much a case that after she fell and hit her head, she became absolutely convinced that she had done something very serious. And she really kind of worried herself into a situation of disability. And I'm sure that that was related to the fact that she had had multiple medical problems throughout her life. She had a history of getting sick and not getting better. So when she had this injury, she believed that this would be exactly the same as what had happened to her in the past. But what helped her really more than any sort of theories about why exactly she developed this problem was for her to see a physiotherapist who basically addressed her fear of walking and her concern that she would never walk again. A psychologically minded physiotherapist can do as much good for somebody like Olivia as psychologist, although she should, of course, also see a psychologist. Now, I just want to, at this point, say that it may be you're thinking, well, not many people, you know, Olivia's situation isn't very common. It's actually surprisingly common, but it isn't necessarily something that will touch everybody in this room. But actually, psychosomatic disorders, in general, will touch everybody in this room. They are, Olivia's is an example of a more extreme form of this, but the less extreme forms of this are incredibly common. So approximately one third of people who go to see a neurologist are believed to have what we call a functional disorder, so a psychosomatic disorder. And those sort of statistics are very similar for all sorts of specialist clinics. So if you see a cardiologist, a respiratory physician, a gynecologist, you'll probably be looking at a third, and up to 50% in some clinics are believed to have purely psychosomatic problems and no disease present. The symptoms pretty much can be anything. So to a respiratory physician, you'll be looking at shortness of breath, pain in the chest, to cardiologists, chest pain, palpitations, joint pains, tiredness. Dermatologists see loads of skin itch and fleeting rashes, and they work very closely with psychologists. So pretty much if you can think of a symptom, it has been generated in that way. So this is a problem that affects a huge number of people. And yet, as I've said, doctors are really not being given the strategies to know how they should deal with these people who comprise one third of their workload in any average clinic. And that's really what I think sort of comes to what needs to be addressed. But I also want to mention actually before that neither is this a problem of any particular country, economic kind of healthcare system or economy. This is a worldwide problem. So there was a World Health Organization study that looked at the rates of this in lots of different countries, as diverse as, I think, Nigeria, Chile, Brazil, the USA, Germany. So lots of different sorts of countries. And going to primary care, it was a similar sort of, at least 20% of people had what are referred to as somatic symptom disorder, so a psychosomatic disorder. So this is something that affects every country, irrespective of sort of health service you have. It's also extremely expensive if we don't deal with it correctly. So in 2005, a study in Boston looked at the cost of medically unexplained symptoms in the USA, and it was estimated to be $256 billion per year. And that was compared with the cost of diabetes, which is obviously a multi-system serious disease, was $132 billion. So this is really this money is going on unnecessary investigations rather than on the actual help that the patients need. And that's what's the greatest shame, is this money is not only, it isn't helping the people it's being spent, but it isn't being beneficial. So really kind of that brings me to the point, which is, you know, what needs to be done. I mean, I think there's several things that need to be done. I think, first of all, we really need to start in medical schools. So this is, doctors are simply not given strategies to deal with people whose tests are completely normal. Now, some people who come to see you will obviously be relieved. They come to see you just to find out that their tests are normal, and that's all that's really needed. But a large proportion of people are not pleased to hear that their tests are normal. So they go to the doctor with chest pain, and we expect that when we say you don't have a heart disease, that you should all be delighted. But unfortunately, that isn't the way it works, because you still have the chest pain, and we're not taught strategies to deal with that. It's also very much treated as a diagnosis of exclusion. So there's a real, like, illness and disease are not the same thing. So disease is a kind of pathological process, and illness is your perception of how you feel. So you can feel ill without having a disease, and you may have a disease, for example, asthma, but not be ill. We're taught to look for disease, and when we've ruled out disease, then we've done our job. We worry terribly about missing diseases, and that's why people like Olivia can manage to go 10 years without anyone adequately addressing the diagnosis. I suspect people did try to address the diagnosis with her in the past, but their major concern was to make sure she didn't have a disease that they missed and that would later come back to haunt them. The consequence is that doctors are afraid to raise this with patients because we're worried about upsetting people, and we're worried that in a couple of years' time you'll find out you have a disease and then you'll come back and be really angry. And therefore we neglect this as if it was unimportant. We also, as I say, make it a diagnosis of exclusion. So we say, well, you come to me with chest pain, I'm going to spend the next 6 months looking for heart and lung diseases, and at the end of that 6 months, maybe I'll raise this with you. Well, I would say, tell me at the beginning and treat these things as equal so that I don't have to wait 6 months of invasive investigations to consider this other possibility. So I think we need to teach doctors strategies of raising this with patients. We need to develop better kind of multidisciplinary teams. So if you had diabetes or epilepsy or multiple sclerosis, you'd see a multidisciplinary team dedicated to your problem. This is every bit as common as any of those disorders, and yet there's hardly any services for this. They're very fleetingly available. What we really need is the same multidisciplinary services that you get for anything else, which would be a physiotherapist, an occupational therapist, a psychologist, a medical doctor, so you can approach everybody according to what they need individually. But I think more than any of that, basically, because I'm letting you guys off the hook enormously, which I absolutely didn't intend to do, which is basically, you know, what we need to address really is our general attitudes to this. Because I think that essentially, you know, it is the case that if you knew two people and they were both paralyzed from the waist down and one had a spinal cord injury causing their paralysis and the other had a psychosomatic problem causing their paralysis, that we would view those people differently. Now, they are different because one potentially is more treatable than the other, and that person is obviously more fortunate. If you have a psychosomatic condition, you can be made better. But if we disregard you and don't give you the treatment that you need, then you will not get better, in which case you're both equally disabled. So I think until we sort of can look at these disorders and consider them with the same amount of respect, then people are going to continue to struggle to accept the diagnosis. And, you know, that can be sometimes the greatest barrier to making people get better, is to encourage them to accept the diagnosis and realize that it's not a dismissal and it's not an insult. Thank you.
We have a reminder for our listening audience. We're listening to Suzanne O'Sullivan, MD, speaking on her book, True Stories of Imaginary Illness, Is It All in Your Head? And this book will be for sale in the lobby after the program. Please pass your question cards up, and we'll be taking them and asking questions. Thank you. Start with one question. Can one self-diagnose and self-treat psychosomatic illness?
I think you can become familiar with your way. I wouldn't suggest anyone self-diagnose, but once you know your own body, you can become familiar with how it behaves in response to stress. And then in the first instance, I would always encourage people to go to their doctors and to get the proper diagnosis. But once you kind of, I, for example, as I say, get dizziness and a variety of things in response to stresses, once I know that that is what happens to me, then I know when I need to present to the doctor and when I don't. It's actually very handy also to know what your particular sort of ways of responding to stress are, because you can then use that as an indicator that something is wrong before it gets too wrong, basically.
Mm-hmm. Can anxiety and stress trigger a case of hives?
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the commonest things in a dermatology clinic. So we have a lot of psychodermatology clinics that deal with people who have hives, itchy skin rashes, fleeting skin rashes. So absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And don't doctors tend to focus on treating symptoms rather than causes?
Yes, and I think that is what happens, is that, I think that they don't mean to. I think basically we don't want to do that. But I think there's a weird dynamic between patient and doctor where we feel we have to do something. And I think sometimes we don't appreciate that actually we don't actually always have to do something. So if you come to me with a pain, I feel I have to respond to that pain by treating it in some way. So I think we don't intend to do that, but sometimes we feel like it's necessary.
Why do you think there's so little understanding among doctors about psychosomatic illnesses?
I think that there's actually a very good understanding. I think there's a good awareness. I mean, doctors all know that this is part of our workload. We all deal with this on a regular basis. I think that there's a really big problem with training, because it literally is not mentioned in the training of most medical schools. So I think there's a problem with responsibility. So we accept that it's a problem, but we don't think it's our problem. You know, I deal with neurological diseases, not psychosomatic disorders. So I think there's a problem with ownership, and I think there's a problem with training. And I think if we could deal with that at medical school level, it would improve considerably.
Mm. What about the brain and gut connection? I know that they're now saying that the gut biome is to tell the body or the brain what to eat. And so are there other other psychosomatic connections here?
I'm not sure I know the answer to that question. I mean, obviously, there's irritable bowel syndrome. Most people who have irritable bowel syndrome will make a very clear connection between their psychological well-being and their symptoms. I don't know that the bowel tells the brain what to eat. I don't know. My bowel tells me to eat a lot. That's what, but I don't know what the mechanism for that is. I can't quite tell you.
Okay. Where does Munchausen syndrome sit in these circumstances and the ones you described?
Yeah, I mean, Munchausen syndrome, so this shouldn't be mistaken with Munchausen syndrome, but I have to say Munchausen syndrome is absolutely the worst thing. It is a terrible disorder for someone to suffer with. So Munchausen syndrome, which we now would call a factitious disorder, is one in which basically people fake illness for a certain kind of attention. So it's different to psychosomatic disorders, because in a psychosomatic disorder, it's completely unconscious. So you have no control over the symptoms and you really aren't aware where they're coming from. In Munchausen syndrome, people are deliberately feigning illness. So they may do something like put eye drops in to dilate a pupil, which is something that makes people worry, that the neurologists really worry that there's something serious wrong, or put blood in their urine to make it appear that they have a bladder problem. Now, these people are doing this for a specific type of care. And I think it's a kind of, it's a disrespected disorder, because people kind of think, oh, you know, what's, you know, that's not a serious problem. That is unbelievably difficult to manage problem. It's extremely difficult to treat. People who have fictitious disorders often tour hospitals. You know, the minute their problem is discovered in one hospital and someone realizes that they're pretending, they will go to another hospital. They're desperate for a certain kind of care. And it really is a very, very difficult problem to manage. And people very rarely recover from it. So I would, they're related but different disorders. And I would say that Munchausen syndrome is people get better from psychosomatic disorders. Very difficult to get better from Munchausen.
Thank you. Would you say this is a growing issue problem, or something that's always existed in about the same proportion?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very often asked if the internet has made this kind of more prevalent, etc. No, this has always been hugely prevalent. The only thing that changes really is how the symptoms present and what we attribute them to. So, you know, 100 years ago, people were having just as many of these seizures as they are having now. But in the past, we will have attributed them to different things. In the 1980s, everything was due to candida infections. These years, everything is due to gluten insensitivity and allergies. So we have, sorry, I've just insulted. If you've got rotten vegetables to throw at me, that would be a good time to throw them. But basically, you know, we attribute, these symptoms are as common as they ever were. The only thing that changes really is the trend for how we account for them.
Thank you. How about schizophrenia? Could that be a psychoneurogenic and of social origin?
I would say that schizophrenia is a completely separate, entirely separate psychiatric condition, and I wouldn't consider it related to this at all.
What about irritable bowel syndrome?
There's absolutely no doubt that, you know, emotional things affect irritable bowel syndrome, and I think most sufferers can make that connection quite easily, and very often gastroenterologists will work with psychologists to help address those issues. So I certainly think that is a psychologically driven disorder.
Can't a reservoir of yeast overgrowth in the intestine lead to recurring yeast infection elsewhere? And can't antibiotics lead to yeast infections? Psychosomatic.
Quite. You're a bit outside my, I mean, sure, all of those things are possible, but I think that basically very often people are put on, that may be related to what I said about Olivia taking long-term antibiotics for her bladder problem. Very, very commonly I've seen people put on long-term antibiotics for, you know, it isn't very, very difficult to get a diagnosis of specific things, even if you don't have them. If I wanted to be diagnosed with a urinary tract infection, I need only give enough urine samples and eventually one of them would come back as positive, because medical tests are not straight. There are clearly abnormals and there are clearly normals, and then there's a huge batch of gray area tests. And if you want any specific diagnosis, this is not a recommendation. You can shop around and you will get it. And basically, I think when doctors are looking for explanations for things, it makes us feel better to give you an explanation, because then you will be happy that we've given you one. And then we'll give you a treatment and you'll also be happy about that. So sometimes things are overdiagnosed, unfortunately.
How might the biofeedback process apply to psychosomatic disorders?
Yeah, I don't have any special knowledge about biofeedback at all, but I think it certainly has been my patients have used it and it certainly has been beneficial for them. It's really, you know, just learning about your body and paying attention, and it's related.
What about migraine sufferers? Is this a psychosomatic?
Well, I don't think we usually consider migraine to be a psychosomatic disorder, although I'd imagine there are people who have chronic headache that is labeled as migraine that might be psychosomatic. So I'd imagine there may be an overlap with misdiagnosis on occasion, but in general, we don't regard true migraine as being psychosomatic.
Have brain waves of hyposomatic paralyzed people been compared to non-hyposomatic normal people and truly paralyzed?
I mean, the brain waves is a measure for consciousness. So I'm not sure if that's about paralysis. That would be a different thing. I'm not sure I fully understood that.
I didn't either. How about the placebo effect? Has that been studied?
Well, it hasn't been particularly studied, but what placebo effect is what your doctor is doing all the time with your psychosomatic symptoms. It's when you go in and say, I think this symptom might be something serious, and they examine you and they tell you that you have a cold and it'll be better in 5 to 10 days. That's a placebo effect. So basically, you know, it hasn't been formally studied, but it unequivocally is beneficial, and as part of a doctor's job is to offer you that sort of reassurance.
Is there a link between psychosomatic disorders and autoimmune disease?
No, there's no link at all, but a lot of people who believe they have autoimmune disorders don't. And that's another hugely overdiagnosed condition. Autoantibodies, if I tested everybody in this room, I'm not a specialist in autoimmune disorders, but if you did a blood test for autoimmune disorders in everyone in this room, you would get multiple positive tests. And depending on how good or bad a doctor I am, how I interpret those tests, I may or may not diagnose you correctly with an autoimmune disorder. So if I suspected I had an autoimmune disorder, I'd be very picky and choosy about what doctor made that diagnosis for me, because it's very, very overdiagnosed by doctors who don't know how to interpret the tests.
Would treating these disorders benefit from a team of effort looking at the mind, the body, and the spirit?
I think that's exactly what we need, because everyone's going to be a bit different. And some people do need more of a kind of help with psychological issues. And some people need more help with physical, practical issues. So really, I think it very much has to be a team effort, because I don't think two people are often very comparable in this field.
Do you consider fibromyalgia and or chronic fatigue syndrome psychosomatic?
Yeah, you might get your rotting vegetables out again now. I do think that fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome, I'm sorry, some people find this view offensive. From my point of view, psychosomatic disorders, I see people whose lives have been ruined by this problem. You know, because the seizures, for example, that you get in psychosomatic disorders are much more aggressive than the seizures you get in epilepsy. So they last longer. They can last an hour. Epileptic seizures last a couple of minutes. Dissociative seizures last an hour. You're more likely to end up in intensive care unit. I consider this disorder to be extremely serious and life-destroying. And therefore, if I say that I think fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome are also psychosomatic, I don't mean that in any way to indicate that I think that means that they are less important, that they are less serious than if they had an autoimmune or other cause. I think they're very serious problems. I think they're particularly serious because they're not measurable. It's really challenging to suffer with something like fatigue, because you can tell people you're tired, and we've all been tired. So we all think, well, I'm tired. You know, I don't hear about your tiredness. You know, I was up late last night. But, you know, the kind of tiredness you get in chronic fatigue syndrome is a whole other level of tiredness. But because we all think we know what tiredness feels like, we don't have the sympathy for those sort of complaints that we do for something like paralysis or a seizure. So, sorry, that was a very long answer. Yes.
I think you may have discussed this in your talk, but what is your hunch about the non-traumatic related mechanisms of psychosomatic?
Yeah, I think that's a super important point, actually, which is worth emphasizing, because for a very long time, if you had something like paralysis or seizures and you went to a doctor, you would basically, it would automatically be assumed that you had suffered some psychological trauma. And that would set up this sort of thing between doctor and patient, where the doctor's going, oh, what's bothering you? There must be something. And the patient's going, no, there isn't anything. And, you know, that just, that conflict between patient and doctor was really problematic. So absolutely trauma is important. But in other cases, trauma is not important. That this is just a, it's maybe it's a way that you respond to being ill. So a lot of the people I see with seizures, for example, it began with a faint. So a common scenario would be someone fainted on the underground. So the London Underground is very overcrowded and a lot of people faint on it. You faint on it, you wake up, you're surrounded by strangers. The next day you've got to get on that same underground and you're worried about getting on the underground and then you collapse again and that sets off a kind of a chain of fear and avoidance. So sometimes these problems are about fear and avoidance and worrying about what's going to happen next and how you've learned to view your health from your family. So if every single time, if you had very sick parents when you were a child, it may be a way that you know of expressing the need for help, for example. So there are many different mechanisms. Trauma is important, but it, by all means, it's not the only thing that can cause this.
Okay. How well does hypnotherapy work in treating psychosomatic?
Well, yeah, it's a controversial one. I mean, some people are doing hypnotherapy. I mean, hypnotherapy was used, you know, 100 years ago, and it fell out of favor because of this idea that you can implant memories and because people are very suggestible during hypnosis. So it is a very controversial therapy that no one in the center that I'm working with uses it. However, it can be useful in certain circumstances. In people who have psychogenic paralysis, for example, they do either hypnotize them or give them drugs like propofol, make them suggestible, and people can walk during hypnosis when they can't walk at other times. They're videoed walking, and then they're shown the video afterwards, and in that way convinced that, you know, they have retained the ability to walk, but whatever stopping them walking is not related to a disease process. I mean, it's difficult because, you know, it raises the possibility of really upsetting people, and there is issues with suggestibility.
How do recent news stories about voluntary amputations fit in? Would these be considered psychosomatic cause?
Yeah, people do talk. People do talk doctors into performing amputations. This is a feature of psychosomatic disorder, chronic pain. Unfortunately, I mean, it doesn't get rid of the pain. That's the worst part of it. Is yes, people do with chronic pain have talked doctors into doing multiple amputations. And what happens when you do that is not only have they lost a limb, but the pain moves somewhere else. So it's a travesty, yeah.
Final question. Can you explain Munchausen by proxy?
Yeah, Munchausen's by proxy is where you are basically, Munchausen's is where you're faking illness for yourself. Munchausen's by proxy is where typically a mother and a child, the mother is faking illness in the child, perhaps giving them drugs and then bringing them into hospital or in some way faking illness. So it's when you do it to somebody else.
Okay, our thanks to our speaker, Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan, for her talk tonight. And now this program, sponsored by the Commonwealth Clubs, celebrating its 114th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.